Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille with The Positive Mind. WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial, bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. And today we're going to talk about sex. Yes, yes, yes. We can't leave it out. Seems that sometimes we get so over-intellectualized we forget about mating itself. And in fact, we have in the studio with us Esther Perel, P-E-R-E-L, who wrote a very, very exciting book and has done some very dramatic research into sexuality. The name of the book is called Mating in Captivity. And it's subtitled Reconciling the Erotic and the Domestic. And my friends, where there are so many issues about sexuality, about where it crosses over, about fantasy, about what's right and what's wrong, and what's the proper way and not proper way, Esther Perel goes around town sparking people into reconsideration of what they thought might be right and might work and hasn't been working. Let me introduce you. Esther, welcome to WBAI.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Tell me, what do you see as the primary problem facing people in America today dealing with their sexuality, or in the world? We don't have to limit it to America.
No, it's interesting you ask in the world, because originally when I wrote the book, I thought that it was going to be written from the perspective of a foreign therapist that observes American sexuality. And now that I actually am on a world tour, I'm realizing that perhaps what I was trying to hone in on was the conundrum of modern couples in the West all over. I think that there are a number of dilemmas of desire in a way that we are facing, but probably one of the ones that I was particularly intrigued by was the fact that there is a generation of people that are post-sexual revolution, that have taken on many of the egalitarian ideals of feminism, that are post-contraception, which has finally given women some sense of safety vis-à-vis their sexuality, that often have nomadic, prolific sexual experiences before they commit themselves, could have as much sex as they want, and are actually having very little of it, at least in the context of their relationships. And they are stumped by it.
And go ahead, continue. So what do you think is the stumping part?
Well, I think that part of what they thought was that when you love, you desire automatically. That if you have permission, you will want it. And that perhaps the erotic doesn't necessarily follow those rules. That sometimes the erotic may be more transgressive and more lured by the forbidden than by what is immediately available. That the fact that maybe love and desire, they relate and they conflict. And herein lies the mystery of eroticism.
You mean love and desire, you mean maybe intimacy and desire conflict? Do you think that's possible? I mean, here we are learning that the closer you get to somebody, hopefully the hotter the sex is going to be. And obviously that's not true. Most couples kind of fizzle out.
I think that we were always told that greater intimacy guarantees better sex. And my experience was that that's not always the case. That in fact, it's not always the lack of closeness that stifles desire, but sometimes too much closeness. That what we seek in love, in terms of closeness, familiarity, predictability, security, reliability, all those anchoring elements of life sometimes butt heads with the fact that eroticism thrives on novelty, on mystery, and even on risk.
Oh, you said a lot there, Esther Perel. Esther Perel, author of Mating in Captivity, my friends. We're going to get ready for a hot couple of hours here. We are talking about some very interesting stuff. Now, wait a minute, Esther. I mean, they said that, you know, marriage leads to the ultimate kind of fulfillment. And when you make love, when you're married and you're a committed relationship, whether it's heterosexual, homosexual, whatever it is, you can have this great passionate thing the closer you get. And you're saying what many people have found, that familiarity makes the parts grow softer. Not necessarily fonder, that you don't necessarily feel as attracted, that you somehow feel like you're suddenly with your brother or your sister or your mother or your father, but you don't have that passion, that verve, that fire anymore. Is that what you're saying?
Well, I think that the first idea that marriage is going to lead to the ultimate erotic fulfillment is in itself a rather new idea. You know, we married or mated traditionally for economic support, companionship, family life, children, respectability. We didn't particularly seek passion in marriage. Passion was somewhere else, if anywhere at all, and usually for men. So that idea that we can at the same time still have all those ingredients that we attributed to marriage and now also want a best friend, a trusted confidant, and a passionate lover all in one, maybe that's part of what makes it more complicated. But more importantly, I think that, you know, when you want intimacy, or maybe when you think about what happens in love, when sometimes you experience the selflessness that comes with love, the kind of worry of responsibility that you feel for the person that you care about so much, it sometimes actually goes in a paradoxical relation with this kind of selfishness of desire, the fact that desire needs a certain autonomy and a certain space to thrive, and it is a space that often in our modern relationships, in with the kind of sovereign imposition of intimacy, we don't allow ourselves to experience.
So how would you go about getting them? Well, I mean, that's a big part of the question here. Let's talk about passion itself. Are you saying that if people felt a little more distant, a little more mysterious, a little more unsafe with each other, that they would bang up a storm?
Yes, in a way, I would say that passion is commensurate with the amount of uncertainty that we can tolerate.
Let's stick with that for a second.
That excitement and insecurity actually somehow go together, but we don't want that insecurity in the context of our committed relationships. We want that other side, and then we complain that we are bored and that the mystery is gone.
Esther, you know, many men have talked about their women who so frequently have said to them, I want you to tease me. I want you to tease me. I want you to bring me so close to the brink, but I want you to tease me. I don't want you to take me over to the edge right away. Do you think that relates to this need to have distance and mystery, and that the very act of the sexual tease is part of the creating the distance?
I think that teasing is about building anticipation. And anticipation is an essential ingredient of the erotic. Teasing and anticipation allows for the plot to kind of unfold in our mind. I think teasing is about making me want, not just experiencing your wanting, but your wanting actually eliciting my wanting. That's the tease. It's a kind of an approach avoidance. It's come close, but don't overwhelm me so that I can then come closer to you. Teasing is about playfulness. You know, it's about flirting. And flirting in French comes from the French word fleuret, which is the tip of the sword. It means teasing. It means eliciting the possibilities without instantly going for the result.
That was interesting to hear. So if you're not going for the results and we have somebody and we're trying to get couples to get a little hotter with each other, I mean, is everything okay? I mean, what if the people start unfolding their fantasies? What about sexual fantasies? Most men nowadays are hiding themselves in the basements of their homes, looking at pornography on the internet and masturbating to some kind of a thing, which is considered a horrendous thing to the women's activists who say this is terrible objectification of women and we should shut off their computers and have them restricted so they can't see pornography because pornography is evil. What do you think?
I think the question about fantasy and the question about pornography are two different questions.
Good. Let's put them apart.
Separate them? Okay. The question of fantasy is that I happen to think that our fantasy life is probably one of our most imaginative, resourceful abilities that we have. You know, if we didn't have fantasy, we wouldn't be able to live on a broader scale. It is what allows us to transcend the limits of reality. In fantasy, I can be irresistible even if in real life I'm not particularly attractive. In fantasy, I can be powerful even if in real life I can sometimes feel weak. In fantasy, I can overcome the limits of my conscience, of my self-image, and of the moral constraints. But fantasy is a play arena. It's a theater. It's a stage. It's not what we really want in reality. It's a place where we could actually sometimes experience that which we would never want in reality. Pornography, what is it I think that men sometimes look at?
Well, wait, let's back up to the fantasy for a moment. Thank you. You say never what, yet I've met so many people who, when they finally act out their sexual fantasy and they find a willing partner, they do want it. This is exactly what I wanted. I wanted someone to master me, or I wanted someone to be my slave. And this is what I really wanted the whole time.
In fantasy, on that theater, on that stage, it's the play. It's like a kid who plays fireman. They know that they're not a fireman. You know, in order to be mastered in your fantasy, you can't be a prisoner in real life. You can never play being a prisoner when you are actually imprisoned in real life. You can want that because it's not what is happening to you. Yes, people can play out their fantasy, but they are playing out their fantasy.
You don't believe there's anybody who wants to actually be a prisoner to their man, kept at home, waiting there so that when he comes home and he desires him, and that's all they do is stay there, prepare for him? You don't think there's anybody who really wants that? You know, as well as being a sexual fantasy about being available for somebody 24/7, you don't think there's somebody who says, but this is what I really want. I want to be taken care of. I want to be watched after. I want to be nurtured. You don't believe, you think that's just sexual fantasy?
No, but I think that when you use it like that, you use the word sexual fantasy in a very narrow way. No, I think some people want to experience their fantasy not just once in a while. They actually like it as a premise for their life. That I do think exists. But for me, the line is always, how rigid is it? You know, the rigidity in terms of this is the only thing that I can get off on and nothing else will get me there. That is where sometimes fantasy passes over into what we sometimes have called perversion, when it becomes actually a thing that drives us solely rather than something that enriches us and infuses us with more. It's different. Enrichment versus condition.
I understand what you're saying, all right? We were talking to Esther Perel, by the way. The name of the book is Mating in Captivity. Also available on a talking book, which is just fantastic, especially if you're traveling in a car with somebody you love. Just got to keep pulling over, I think. It's a very, very exciting way you've done your presentation here. I want to go back to the psychological, which combines with the sexual, which combines with the sexual acting out. Do women want to be submissive? Do men want to be submissive? Is this whole dominant submissive theme something that is a yearning that's deeply on the inside that people don't let themselves recognize? Is that what you believe? Do you think that there's something about it that goes beyond the sexual to a more, I just want to give up, I want to be in somebody's hands?
I want to be back as a little child who is held and who is taken care of, and where someone else can intuit my needs without my even having to articulate them.
That's you talking about yourself now.
No, I talk about... Once in a while, I could very well imagine giving up some responsibility and making someone else...
But you would let someone else, right? Because you're in charge. You're a dominant. You top from below.
Yeah. When you submit, you decide. When you submit in fantasy, you decide how submitted you want to be. But for me, the submission, the surrender of power, goes hand in hand with the experience of feeling taken care of.
Sure.
It is not experienced as an act of aggression.
Of
it is experienced as an act of care. And that's often the misunderstanding of the issue of power and submission. I think that women often have fantasies of forced seduction. That doesn't instantly mean rape fantasies, by the way. But what they describe when they talk about the forced seduction is actually that somebody wants them that much that they are relentless about their pursuit, and that conveys that she is utterly irresistible. And then when she finally gives in, she gives in to someone who is in fact very caring. And the aggression was a way of getting her. It's not experienced as an act of violation in the fantasy. I don't think anybody in real life wants to be coerced and forced.
Yes, but now this crosses over the political barriers, you know, or the difficulties where people say, hey, but you've got to be your own in control all the time guy.
Yeah, that's an American idea.
Tell me about it.
The idea of self-control, this ultimate value about self-control, you know. I think that people have, erotic desire is politically incorrect. It doesn't play by the rules of good citizenship. You know, there are a host of feelings in desire that are not egalitarian or fair you know, or consensus, they are often played out around issues of power, exchanges of power. And I think that when people want to give over the power, they voluntarily do so to somebody that they trust, where they feel safe, and where they know that they can at any point say no.
And so you think having the power to say no allows you to surrender. Now, what's the advantage of the surrender? What's the advantage of the letting it go at that point? What's the advantage? Tell me, as the experience of somebody who surrenders, what's the experience like?
Bliss. Utter feeling that you are in the hands of someone who will never harm you, who will take care of you, who will nurture you, who will hold you, who will carry you up. The kind of giving over of yourself, the merging, it is really often an ecstatic experience. It is sometimes the closest that we get to experiencing the divine, no, isn't it? For some people, that's the description. There's kind of momentary submission, because it's always a momentary submission. There is something about that that is enormously primal, archetypal, young, that we sometimes strive back to this kind of original oneness that we think we once had. Maybe we never really had it, but it's certainly a powerful lure.
Do you think that it's equally luring to men as it is to women? Do you think men want this same submission?
No, generally less. There is quite a group of men who also yearn for that. And it is a kind of a yearning, actually. That's a yearning for oneness. But I think that often men experience oneness as something that is much more threatening to a kind of obliteration of themselves. And part of that has to do with the socialization of
God. Could you slow that one down just a little for me? It was a good sentence.
I think that men are sometimes more afraid of that kind of merging because it threatens them with a dissolution, an obliteration of their self, their sense of self. And part of that is because so much of masculinity is predicated on separateness, on separating oneself from the original tie with the mom. And it is, there is something for men that kind of deep surrender taps into a loss of masculinity that women do not feel.
Well, do you think that might be organic? Do you think it may be something we inherited? Or do you think it's pathological? Do you think it's, 'cause the way you're sounding, you sound like you're saying, oh, this is men's neurosis. They can't give up that well.
No, I don't think it's pathological. I think that manhood is predicated, and the way we raise boys makes it so that for many men, the experience of surrender is often felt as more threatening than it is for women. I don't think that there are plenty of men who yearn for it and love it and playfully would love to be in the hands of someone else. But there's more men who actually are on the other side.
Are there men who would playfully like to be in the hands of other women, of women who would like to surrender to women completely and just be on the receiving end of everything a woman has to offer, including the caring and nurturing, just as there are women who would like to receive it from men?
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
And do
yes.
you think it's ever possible that that couple gets together, or do you think it's usually one way or another? The man doing it with the woman taking the surrender, or mm-hmm. the man taking the surrender?
I think that the men I have met, for example, who go to a dominatrix, which is often the ritualized stage where men can voluntarily go and surrender themselves in that way, they tend to not have relationships with a woman who is a dominatrix. There is something about allowing that to take place in your fantasy life that is not necessarily what you want in your everyday life. The structures are separate. I think that it's very interesting sometimes to see a man who can be all upset about his controlling wife, but then in his fantasies is all about surrendering to the control of a woman, but not from his wife.
Now, we had that up in, I don't know if you know about Washington, D.C. In Washington, D.C., one of the most common of all fantasies has been, according to the Mayflower Madam, I think was the name of the book. And she said that when all the men who would come to her, these were the strongest men who were in government, and what they would want to do is be dominated.
Right.
You know, be
right.
tied up and bound and so on and so forth. But it still begs the question, are you saying that a man wants that according to the stereotypic, not stereotypic, but the way you understand women to be, women want to surrender in general, and they would want the sexual surrender so that they could enter the bliss of the sexual surrender and the nurturance that goes with it. And that men might like that, but there's something about masculinity that fights against it. So they may take it passively, like oral sex or something, for a short period of time. But they really don't allow themselves to go there the way a woman can. Do you think that a woman has access to a level of sexuality, a level of surrender that no man probably could ever really know?
No. I think that actually I would present it differently. I think that the reason maybe that women became more at ease with that kind of fantasy has to do with the fact that female sexual aggression was shunned. And the fantasy of forced surrender is a vicarious way for women to actually experience power when they usually were not allowed to experience it. So the surrender is actually a roundabout way to experience power. It's not just surrender. Because when you are irresistible, you are powerful. When you make him pursue you to the end, you are powerful. Then only you surrender. And the surrender piece of it is about this kind of giving yourself over. But it, part of the giving over had to do with the fact that women could not usually allow themselves the fantasies of the other side. I think that for men, there are, you know, you can go both ways, and there are plenty of men who have fantasies on both sides. My experience definitely is that when I look at who are the people who particularly enjoy the being taken over, it is often people who actually have power in other parts of their life. And what they really enjoy is the kind of giving it up for a while into the trusting hands of someone who's going to be able to make all the decisions for them. It's the mother who is in charge of the kids, who has her job, the career. It's the man who runs the high-powered company and who wants to be able to experience the shadow side of themselves in a safe place when they can't always allow for that to happen in the other parts of their room, their house, or their life.
What you're saying, though, is that the woman submits. You know the expression, topping from below, I'm
right,
sure.
Right, right.
You're talking about that.
That's right. That's right.
Would you explain what topping from below is?
No, actually, you explain.
No, you explain.
It means that, you know, what appears on the surface isn't exactly what it looks like. You know, that the person who seems to be in charge is actually enslaved to the attraction that they feel from the other person, and that the person who seems to be surrendering is actually powerful by the fact that they're irresistible.
Gee, you didn't know the answer. Esther Perel. Esther, Mating in Captivity. This is Armand DeMille. So now if we want to get this event to get back this spark, I'm sure some people are listening and some people are throwing the radio on the floor and other people are saying, well, now how do we get some of that besides getting the book Mating in Captivity? How do we get some of that? What is the step? What is we going to do? My husband, he wants to, you know, how do I get him turned on? How do I get him to want to take me? Or how do I get my wife to be responsive, if that's the model we're working in? And I'm going to use a heterosexual model, but I'm sure we could go just about anywhere with this. What do they do? What should they do? What do they have to get out of their minds? What do you do? Walk in the house and clear the table and, you know, throw everything on the floor and take your wife right there? What do you do? What's your idea of how this happens?
Of how people have a spark?
Do people think about it? Do people plan it? Do people get, you know...
Oh, I think there's a lot of things that go into this. You know, that's part of why I was much more interested in writing a book about desire than about sex. Because the issue often is that people lack desire. Once they have that, they don't need my help with sex.
Okay, so how do we fuel the desire?
I think that in the context of a committed relationship, and for that matter, a third of my practice is same-sex couples. So I've noticed that a lot of this has more to do with the relationship and roles and dynamics than specifically about gender categories, you know. But committed sex is premeditated sex, that I know. And we don't necessarily trust premeditated sex in the context of our secure homes.
Let's back that up. Committed sex is premeditated sex?
Yes.
What does that mean?
It's sex that you want, that you plan, that you consciously will. It's not sex that you just wait for it to happen. It's not the Big Bang theory of spontaneity. You know, because when you want it to just happen, you actually never have to fully own it. Premeditated means that you own your wanting, which means desire. First of all.
First step. First okay. step, everybody owns it. You want it.
Yes.
Okay, step one.
Step one. Step two is you are willful and intentional about it, which means that you make it happen. And the making it happen means you cordon off an erotic space in your life with this partner. What that means is sometimes time, sometimes physical space, but it means a place where people can meet to experience pleasure with each other, and that means also outside the bedroom. Pleasure for its own sake is the definition of the erotic. That sense where people maintain a sense of interest in each other, an aliveness, a gaze, a particular kind of gaze that is not one where they take each other for granted and treat each other like a worn-out sofa. The third thing is you plan. But planning in this country often becomes scheduling, blackberries, work, and obligation rather than a creative act of building anticipation and longing where people start to allow their plot, their narrative in their head that is part of the wanting to proliferate in their mind, you know. And it always was like that, by the way, even before they were together. It was never just spontaneous. There always was a plot. I think that too often couples forego the plot. They forego the building of desire. They forego seduction because the idea is now that you're with me and that you're my partner, you should just want it because I want it at the same time. You know, I don't have to elicit the desire in you. Back to your question about the teasing. And seduction is an invitation, you know. I've never known a person to cook a beautiful meal and make a beautiful table and create an ambiance and the light and the music and their partner come in and say that they would rather have had a Big Mac. Isn't it? It is about a ritual. It is about a certain way of being present for each other and with each other. And it is about not just saying, I need, but saying, I want. And that's really the difference. Because if you come to your partner in a state of need, then the partner will often feel that they have to take care of you. And taking care of elicits love, but not necessarily desire.
So let's say that you do have this, and you're saying, you know, we're going to plan the desire, and you have the desire, but your partner doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
What do? How do you get it?
You try to elicit it as best you can.
How do you elicit?
Sometimes it's by washing the dishes when they feel overwhelmed. Sometimes it's by letting them sleep when they are very tired. Sometimes it's by taking them outside the house and saying, come, you need a break, let's go for a walk. Sometimes it's by saying, you know what, we need a hotel room because in this house there's too much of a mess and too many phone calls and too many interruptions. Sometimes it's about just looking at them and saying, I miss you. Sometimes it's about looking at them and saying, you're beautiful. You know, and I want you. That's how you elicit the desire. You don't just say, let's have sex tomorrow at 10. Foreplay is a little more than that.
Is it anything about making yourself attractive, to look attractive?
Also.
I mean, this is also what you do. What do you think about what you do to your physical self as your own physical presentation? Because you talked about intrigue, you know, and you talked about, like, washing the dishes with your clothing off or washing, you know, I mean, do you add anything to it? Do you bring a sexuality to your body as well? You know, is there something different that you might do?
Look, sometimes you people just do the dishes and it's perfectly fine as is, and sometimes they can be playful enough and they actually do the dishes with a hat on their head and nothing on the body. That depends on how playful and mischievous, if you want, a couple can be. I think that by definition, the more imaginative, the more playful, the more you can introduce novelty, the more you can break with routine, the more erotic it can be. But sometimes it's also simply for people to remain physically connected.
Very important.
That they don't just go from nothing to sex. You know, there is a whole range of sensuality and physicality between two people that often people forego.
Including sleeping together and touching.
People
Absolutely. In these huge double beds that people have nowadays in their homes, they have two people lost on two sides of the bed and they barely even touch any longer. So the contact doesn't take place. A touch of the hand and the rubbing next to somebody, you know, sitting in individual consoles in a home, in a living room, watching television but not touching. There is so little touch, and I think the touch sends the pheromones, sends the messages.
And the oxytocin.
And the oxytocin.
And the oxytocin. But you know,
well,
there was
oxytocin's a little dangerous, isn't it? Because the oxytocin could make you just want to hug them.
That's right. It can make you become very affectionate, but not very erotic.
Right.
You know, sometimes there are couples for whom physical affection actually works as a sexual appetite suppressor.
Yes.
It can work the other way around.
Yes, and because it could feel nurturing and it could be maternal and it could be this. Let's explain what the oxytocin difference is here.
Well, if I follow the model that Ellen Fisher talks about, there are three systems in the brain: lust, romance, and attachment. The lust system in the brain goes with testosterone, which is really the hormone of lust and desire, whereas the hormone of romance is vasopressin and dopamine, and the hormone of attachment is oxytocin. When women experience orgasm, they release oxytocin. When women nurse, they release oxytocin, and the oxytocin sometimes can work against the testosterone. Or, another way of saying it, it is one of the way we understand why women get attached when they have sex, why they've often connected and the man can keep it more separate, is also explained because of the production of oxytocin that actually binds them, attaches them, connects them to this man with whom they just had sex, and for him it sometimes could have been just that, and for her it becomes more than that. And some people say that it is also driven by our brain physiology.
And so when the oxytocin is present, and you have this kind of bonding chemistry between two people now. Here they are, and they're really connected to each other, and they feel very close. They have the potential now to either go in one direction or another. They could go to sleep, or that could get turned on into a little more testosteronic
right.
sexuality.
Do you know what produces testosterone? Novelty. Novelty. The same way as from an evolution perspective, what brings the testosterone is to run into a new person, a new mate, and then to want to actually bring them toward you, and then to actually make them stay long enough so that you could have the child with them. That's the way Ellen Fisher describes it. And it was very interesting for me because I always talked about novelty, but I had never connected it with the production of testosterone. Now I understood that there actually was a biological component to as an underpinning for my argument. If you want.
So therefore you're saying you got to go get the neighbor and bring her in the house.
That's one way to elicit the imagination.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's talk about monogamy for a minute.
Yes.
This is an interesting concept, don't you
the
think?
The sacred cow of the romantic ideal.
Well, we did a program recently on monogamy, and we're trying to find out which of the... there were no animals left. They found through DNA studies there wasn't a single animal left on the planet that's monogamous. We used to think there was just a certain few that would choose their mates. But according to DNA, it's not true. It's according to everybody will, and that, you know, one out of every 10 children born are born to a father other than the one that their wife is married to, which is kind of remarkable. Mm-hmm. Have you heard such a thing?
No.
It's remarkable.
Very interesting.
It's amazing, yes. So it's saying that, you know, 1 out of 10 women are having relationships with men and becoming pregnant and keeping that baby at home, you know, with the husbands they have. So novelty, and men, you know, are always accused of having fooling around and going out, and women seem to be having 51% of all women at this point, I think the claim is, have had relationships outside of their marriage.
51% of women?
51%. So we're at a new level of it. So what is monogamy, and what do you think of it, and do you think that it's essential for a relationship? Do you promote polygamy or polyamorous relationships?
How many minutes do I get for that one?
As long as you need.
Look, I think that, you know, people often ask me, you know.
By the way, Esther.
Yes.
God bless you for being as honest and as forthright as you are, because I love the way you speak about it. It's what you believe. It's what your book talks about. I know your intention. I could tell from your heart that you really care about people. You're not talking about sex. You're not talking about drama. You're not talking about just trying to sell a book. So I really want to thank you for what you're bringing. I love the way you see this.
Thank you. That's a real recognition, you know.
Yeah.
Look, I'm often asked if human beings are monogamous. Do I believe that people are monogamous? And I tend to answer no, but monogamy is human. You know, historically, monogamy was a system of imposition put on women in order to delineate, you know, the economic survival in a patriarchal system. It was about lineage and property. It had nothing to do with love. Today, as part of the romantic ideal, monogamy is all about love. And that, I think, is very important to understand, the social meaning of monogamy. Today, it has gone from being an imposition to becoming a conviction, usually espoused by both partners. Number one. Number two, monogamy is the sacred cow of the romantic ideal. There is something about love and marriage today being predicated on choice. You chose me. Me, I got singled out from the lot. And in that, I became special. And when you go about sleeping with someone else, that sense of specialness feels shattered. It's always a question one has. Why is sexual infidelity more hurtful than any other kind of infidelity? However, I think that more importantly...
When we talk about other kinds of infidelity, if you stole my money from the bank,
that's right,
I'll forgive that. You know, if you do other things, if you lied to
right,
people about
me. Right, we betray each other in so many ways,
right,
you know?
Right, and of all the right, other betrayals, those are forgivable.
Right.
Sexual infidelity, oh my gosh.
Right, it tops them all. It really has a different connotation. But I think more importantly, my position with many couples. I'm not there to advocate where people need to put their boundaries. But I will say to people, monogamy cannot be assumed. It needs to be negotiated. And for that matter, it needs to be renegotiated in the course of a relationship. We live much longer, and if we stay with the same person, we're going to be staying with that person for a long time. Why do we think that we can renegotiate every other aspect of the relationship, but the boundaries is something that we just go about tacitly assuming until the hit the fan, you know? So there are groups today that for me are very inspiring because they are redefining monogamy. And they look at it, particularly work with my gay couples, is that you can see how they seek a definition of monogamy that has to do with emotional commitment and emotional loyalty, but one that is not necessarily bound up with sexual exclusivity. And it is possible to watch how they maintain this over a long time, so that all the straight community that often is very quick at jumping and saying, it's not possible, you can't do it, you know, I think that it's interesting to see how there were plenty of things that used to be forbidden. Premarital sex was forbidden. Homosexuality was totally pathologized. Maybe we have come to a time now where we are going to renegotiate the boundaries. Every couple has boundaries, no matter how open their relationship. Every couple lives in the shadow of betrayal. Every couple can experience the violation of trust. You know, so that, for me, is where it lies. Where people choose to put the boundaries, they need to figure out with themselves, and it changes. I really think it changes.
If a person is... do you think people get over infidelity, and you think that there's a certain adjustment in the mind? I mean, if somebody came to you and they said, my husband cheated on me, help me forgive him, what would you say? What would you do?
What is it that you need to forgive? You know, when you say he cheated on you, means what? He slept with someone else?
He slept with someone else.
Right. Do you know why? Do you know what was it was about? I think that the premise that I often will examine is that we have come to accept that people cheat because they have problems in the marriage.
Well, let's examine the word cheat.
Right.
Because right there we have a word that says cheat. People go outside the marriage mm-hmm. because they have problems in the marriage.
Right.
But if we call it cheating, then it means they're going outside the marriage because they're actually lying and deceiving their partners as part of when you cheat somebody, you steal from them. It doesn't mean you, if you only eat vegetables at home, you're allowed to have a hamburger outside. I'm not sure that's cheating.
No, the cheating
is a betrayal.
That's right. That's right. Because when it is not, when it's not secretive, then we're not talking about cheating or about betraying.
But do you see it as a betrayal?
It's a betrayal if the couple never openly negotiated their boundaries. If they assumed something, if they thought that the boundary around their sexuality was only around the relationship itself, then it will be experienced as a betrayal. The cheating is the violation of the trust. That's what makes it cheating, not what the person did outside with the other person.
So the violation of the trust is going out side of the relationship without discussing it? Is that
right,
what you're saying?
Right. It's the secret negotiation of monogamy.
You know? Who wrote that wonderful book about the different packages of love? Daphne Rose Kingman, right? Daphne, you know Daphne Rose Kingman's work?
No.
Oh, I think we have to give you this book. Daphne Rose Kingman talked about the containers. She said any container at all, any container of love, which could be a menage a trois, it could be five people, it could be an open relationship, it could be closed, it could be monogamous, it could even be non-sexual, is okay as long as it's fully recognized
between
the two people. She called these containers. She said, within the container, there is always a new love that evolves that's different than all other loves. You can't assume that it's the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's a beautiful, beautiful piece of work.
But you know what I have found interesting in my understanding of the word betrayal was that, particularly in this society, when people have fantasies about somebody else than their partner, they already begin to experience it as a form of betrayal. You don't have to literally go outside. Sometimes even just going outside in the confines of your own mind starts to be experienced as the same. And I found that very interesting.
You know, one of the things you mentioned, and you mentioned in your book, is about the lurking presence of a third partner, a third person. There's sometimes a woman will feel turned on to a man. That's a certain thing. And then she finds out that he has other very attractive women attracted to him, and she will be made ravenously hungry for him based on this presence of these other women. What is that about?
I think that when you're less sure that it's yours, you want it more. I think that there is something about wanting to go and capture back that which isn't fully yours. Now, of course, my view is that no matter how close and cozy you are with your partner, they're never fully yours. But we experience it more when the third actually is hovering in the background. And for me, the image of the third came about because I thought, you know, if we have relationships today that are predicated on choice, then it also means that there is all the others who we didn't choose, who we renounced. But that doesn't mean they stop to exist. And in the shadow of every relationship looms that third, you know. And it can be a real person or it can be a fantasy. So when you find your partner, that goes both ways. You can have your partner or a person that you're drawn to and see other people's gaze onto that person, and it makes you really want to launch out and say, no, come to me. And that is a ferocious force of desire. Or you can just basically feel totally threatened by it, personalize it, and say, obviously, if you're looking at others, it means you don't want me. Rather than the recognition of the sovereignty of the erotic mind of your partner that, yes, you may choose me and still want others. That is a very different proposition.
So do you think the limiting behaviors or the attempts to limit the imagination of your partner, what do you think of the fact that since most couples, most men and most women, do spend some time with private sexual stuff besides outside of with another partner masturbating and stuff like that, but they keep it as a secret from their partners. And when their partners discover it, it's, you know, Masters and Johnson's use this as a technique for livening sexuality. They said, go watch your partner masturbate because that would be a fascinating thing.
Mm-hmm.
But most people nowadays have it hidden secret. It's a secret. He's down in the basement and he's working on his computer, and he comes down and she says, what are you looking at? And he's shocked. He's like a little boy.
Right.
He feels frozen. He apologizes. She asks him why he looks at it. Now let's go to that issue about the pornography.
But you see, I think that me personally, I tend to say that everybody should have a secret garden. I think that privacy enhances intimacy. But I think that when you don't give license and permission for people to maintain certain parts of themselves private, then they become perverted into secrecy.
It's because
we don't allow people to maintain their privacy that they begin to experience it as secret. That's the reason it becomes secretive. I think that when there are plenty, you know, and why don't we allow people to maintain that sense of privacy? And why do we take his sitting downstairs as an act of betrayal and he therefore needs to do it as something totally hidden? because we have a model today that says that there is one person with whom you can have everything and for whom you can be everything. And if you want anything else besides me, it becomes a reflection on what I am not and how insufficient I am. And that is a strange equation which forces people to then go into seclusion and to take their erotic imagination underground. That doesn't explain still what he's looking at and what happens to him in the basement. But the idea that people become shameful and embarrassed about being found out because they had something that was supposed to be just for them, and that it is seen as a transgression of the boundary, that, you know, how could you be having this thing that is not something we share, comes out of a model that wants relationship to be about uber-sharing between two people of everything.
But what about it? I mean, there is so often the woman.
Do you understand what I
just
said?
Yes, I understood what you just said. Did you understand it?
I understood it very well. I wasn't sure I said it clearly enough.
No, you know what I think you said, and let me see if that makes a difference. You said, in effect, that it is only a private life. A private life that, for one reason or another, adding the shame from childhood plus this concept that you're supposed to be the one and only, turn into secrecy. Privacy turns into secrecy.
When sharing becomes mandatory, it invites secrecy.
Okay.
And I think that our model of intimacy today has turned sharing into a mandatory effect.
And secrecy turns into shame and therefore anger. And this funny thing about shame, when a man experiences shame with his wife, he turns off sexually to her, is the correlation that we've always found.
Correct.
So that he is feeling shameful about his sexuality, he now turns off to her almost as a revenge, almost like a way of getting even. I will not have this sexuality because of you, and I certainly won't have it with you.
But it's not so much only a revenge, I think, sometimes. It's as if he's been caught by his mother. He's been caught as a little boy who was masturbating, and he no longer can see this person as someone that he would desire because she has become a judge.
Okay. Well, what about women now, women who have brought up the Catholic way, who go to buy their little vibrator, and they're, you know, I don't mean to diminish it, they could buy big vibrators, but they could have their vibrator, and they, in the privacy of their own lives, they have this sexual pleasure when their husband's not around. They would never let their husband know they're doing it. What is that about? Why is that such a secret? Why, they certainly no objection from him.
Oh, I think
most men love the idea.
No. Not all. That's not necessarily the case. And I think that part of why the women don't share it with the men is, in fact, because they are protecting his masculinity. Because many men will experience women's sexual autonomy as a diminishment of their masculine prowess, of their masculinity. If you can do it without me, then what can I bring to you? And I think women have often been reluctant to show their sexual autonomy to men as a way to protect men, actually.
Do you think that it's important that women, that men focus on the woman's orgasm? No segue here, but do you think that it's important that women, that men focus on the woman's ability to have orgasm and have orgasm during sex? Do you think the woman's orgasm is part of his responsibility? She never feels it so much about his responsibility because he's going to take care of himself.
No, I would say it a little differently. I would say that I invite men to be invested and attentive to women's pleasure. And the pleasure for many women isn't always just orgasmic, first of all. I think that when women feel a pressure from the man to get to orgasm, they often experience it less about something that she wants and more something that he needs from her to confirm that he performed adequately, first of all. So the issue is, yes, you are responsible to make sure that she experiences pleasure, but don't make her orgasm something that becomes a measurement for your performance. Next, I think that sometimes women are cautious about allowing themselves to go all the way to orgasm for fear that it takes too long, that he will get bored, that he will lose patience, and I wish that women sometimes felt more entitled sexually and vis-à-vis their pleasure altogether.
What would they do in that case? What would they do if they felt more entitled? They'd say, stick with it, buddy, don't go away.
Yes, or they would stimulate themselves and not feel that they can't touch themselves because he thinks he needs to be the one to do it all, and that they would see that as something that enhances her pleasure, that she not just be passively in his hands, that she not just be all about being desirable, but that she be in touch with her own desires.
But I've spoken with many men who have been husbands and who have had this issue. There's not a man I've ever met who felt threatened by his woman bringing herself to orgasm while they were having sex together. They don't feel threatened. They get turned on by it. They get, as pardon the expression, a second coming.
That's one group of them. That's one group of them.
I guess it's the only group that comes to the DeMel Center. We don't have the other group.
These men are very much there also, and they actually wish that she would own her sexuality and her desires and her pleasures, and that she would actually, you know, be into it for herself and be less passive. And then there is another group of men who I think sometimes see this as a statement about their adequacy. Part, by the way, of what I think men get on the online, and when you look at the kinds of, you know, to go back to and make the connection, I found that, you know, the woman who's online, she's voracious, she's greedy, she's sexual, she's powerful. She never says, not tonight, darling. She says, more, more, more. And she never makes him feel ashamed or embarrassed about his desires. And furthermore, she's always having a great time. So he never has to worry about his inadequacy. He never has to feel insecure. The problem is that he doesn't necessarily attribute those dynamics to the woman that he's with. You know, it's not always the woman he would choose to marry.
Would you say that in general, if a man or a woman were together and the partner wanted sex, they should be, try to make it happen no matter what?
No.
You think sex should always be available?
No. I think that sometimes you should allow yourself to say, I'm not in the mood right now, but I could get into the mood. Or, you know, tonight is not for me, but I'm perfectly happy to do it for her or for him. But I think that sometimes it's perfectly fine for people to say no without the other person to leave utterly wounded by it.
Do you think, Esther, that women are becoming more conscious of, and men as well, of the rhythms of the menstrual cycle that may lead to higher desirability and lesser desirability in certain people at certain times? You know what I mean?
Yes, I wish people actually...
I mean, it just seems like it's... I wonder where men... why they don't go to class.
No, but you know, I think that it's not... the men don't always know it, but in fact, the women don't always know it either.
Well, could you talk a little about it? What do you understand?
That, you know, during ovulation and during menstruation, female sexual desire, because of the hormonal changes, is often more intense. And when you ask people and they tell you it's every 2 months, it's often clear that it's twice a month actually matches the kind of biological cycle.
When you say during ovulation and during the menstrual cycle, when a woman is having a period, she is having the greatest desire, or immediately following her period ending?
No, sometimes it's the days leading to it.
The days leading to it.
Yes.
And you think it's different for every woman, the way the hormones work? Sometimes it's the days leading to it, sometimes the days after it. Do you think there's a fall off after the period?
Yes, I think that often women describe that afterwards it's less. And by the way, the correlation that I make is between how women experience intensified desire around menstruation or around ovulation. I will see how it connects with how they feel in terms of being horny or less when they are pregnant.
Give me that. What do you mean?
That... you know, there are women who during their pregnancy also experience intensified sexual desire. They're just ravenous and they don't understand it. But in fact, it matches the way that they used to experience during ovulation and particularly during menstruation. There are other women who during pregnancy utterly shut down.
So if a woman is in this period of time where she feels very charged and very excited, and let's say she's having a period and it's just about to happen, then we have this correlation of men with funny attitudes towards women's periods. So here women are maybe having their periods, and men have this kind of horrific thing with mm-hmm. blood, mm-hmm. and they avoid it. And how that must work against the passions of a woman.
But
I mean,
that,
there's a
right.
man who could say, I take you all, blood and everything.
Yes. But, you know, the issue of blood and the issue of kind of entering into that bloody womb and all of that, I understand the fears, but also I think that it's important to tell people that sex, even sex between a man and a woman, isn't just intercourse. You know, if that's not where you are drawn to go when she is having her periods, there is still a whole body there. There is still a whole sensuality. There is a skin, there is hair, there is, you know, the idea that we kind of narrow down to a genital view of sexuality that has to do with intercourse and orgasm is often more narrowing than what our bodies and our minds are capable to produce in terms of sexual pleasure.
So if there's a couple and there's somebody who is particularly sensitive to her cycles, and in her cycle she feels more desire at one time than another, which doesn't mean she's not responsive the other times, but there are horny times. Mm-hmm. There are times that she's really ready. The man should learn this, because this is for him a way of both giving to her and giving to himself.
And if you don't want to penetrate her,
take a vacation at that time of the month.
But even more specifically, if you don't want to penetrate her because she is bloody, you know, you can stimulate her nipples and to such a degree that she will also reach a climax. I mean, there is so many other ways to make a woman come that isn't just, you know, focused around his penis and penetration.
If the woman is feeling very stimulated, and what happens when around menopause or perimenopausal time? Does this change with desire? Do the desires change? Does she no longer have it twice a month? Is it now three times a month or four times a month?
I think it's very,
how are the changes?
It's very broad. I'm watching now, you know, particularly perimenopausal women, and I think it really, what is actually more marked in my experience is that it becomes far less predictable, rather than knowing exactly when. However, I think that wherever people are less prone to the machinations of their physiology, if you want, and it's for women, but it's also for men as they get a little older, what makes desire is the illicit imagination. If it's, you know, it's the difference between arousal and desire. And the arousal comes because you have elicited and invited a person into this erotic play, rather than just because you come already aroused, fully charged to your partner. It's a very different dynamic. And people who used to be very sexual and it just was happening to them physically often are the ones who have a harder time understanding that they have to go at it in a very different route at this point.
Our guest is Esther Perel, the name of the book, Mating in Captivity. You have been a wonderful guest here today. We are definitely doing more of this, aren't we?
I'll come back.
Isn't this great?
It's a pleasure.
Wonderful to be with you. We will be back with you in just a little bit.